to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. We broadcast live every Friday from the Vancouver downtown Eastside, Canada. You can stream this show live on cooperadio.org. To listen to past shows, you're welcome to visit our newly revamped website at www.animalvoices.org. I'm joined here today by my lovely co-host, Allison Cole.
Thank you. I am lovely.
And our capable technician, John Pranger. On the first half of the show today, we will be speaking with Dr. Hope Ferdosian from PCRM, the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, about the Great Ape Protection Act. I always say grape, so.
Grape ape.
Yeah. On the second half of the show, we'll be playing a recording of an interview I had with celebrity chef Tal Ronan earlier this week. Tal Ronan is a talented vegan chef who became a star after being chosen to cook for Oprah for her highly publicized 21-day vegan cleanse. But first, Allison, while I was busy working on the show, you were out eating some delicious food again this week.
I certainly was. I had the pleasure of attending Earth Saves Dine Out at Aksum Ethiopian Restaurant this week. Being a fan of Ethiopian food, I had been there just once before last fall and was impressed with the restaurant's generous offerings of fresh and authentic vegan Ethiopian fare. So when this event came up, I took the opportunity to partake again in what I hoped would be another delicious and satisfying meal, which it most certainly was. 28 of us dined on a munificent buffet spread of wholesome vegetable dishes, which included most of the vegetarian items that this omnivorous establishment has to regularly offer. As yet another meat-serving restaurant in the city in a sea of many, I find it really encouraging when you can dine at such a place that has a decent variety of animal product-free dishes to choose from, as is the case on Aksum's menu. We really need more restaurants to be going in that direction, I think. In comparing our regularly or our specially prepared buffet and the items on the menu, I saw that we were able to try out 6 of their 7 regular veggie dishes, and I have to say that all are worth consuming and relishing. For those not familiar with Ethiopian cuisine, it can perhaps be best compared to other ethnic edibles as the East Indian or Middle Eastern variety. Think of a curry explosion of lentils or spinach or a cabbage simmered or sautéed and infused with onions, ginger, garlic, chilies, and other spices. Not to say that it always has to be spicy, as some of our dishes in this meal were not. And let's not forget the spongy injera bread that rounds out and ultimately defines any authentic Ethiopian meal. Made with teff flour, this cushiony delight of iron and fiber-rich goodness acts as a pancake-like scoop to hold your curries and stews, as well as to soak up their flavors. No forks or knives required. On our plates for this evening's dinner, the dishes we savored were miser wat, which are split lentils simmered in a spicy hot sauce, spinach simmered in mild sauce with spices and herbs, atikilt wat, which is cabbage, carrots, and potatoes simmered in a mild sauce, shiro, pureed split peas simmered in a mild sauce, sika alicha, yellow split peas simmered in a mild sauce, indige tibs, which are portobello mushrooms marinated and sautéed with onion, garlic, pepper, tomato, herbs, and spices, and of course the injera bread. Compared to the other Ethiopian restaurants in town that I've been to, the Red Sea Cafe and Ayala restaurant, Aksum is an option on par with the good Ethiopian food offered in Vancouver. The prices are decent at $8 for most dishes, and they also have a $10 veggie plate that has 4 different other veggie options on it. And as a bonus, there is also free parking in the front. For a cruelty-free menu meal with a bit of fire and spice, I recommend treating yourself to this delicious African food experience. Aksum Ethiopian Restaurant is located at 1279 East Hastings Street in Vancouver.
Yeah, and your comment about there being lots of vegetarian options, it seems that
more than average, for sure.
Yeah, it seems that way with a lot of Ethiopian and ethnic foods. Mm-hmm. And I think in our second interview, Tal Ronan will talk about how, you know, it's only in North America that we eat so much animal protein. And elsewhere, people eat a lot of plant protein.
For sure, for sure.
So
And then that's why they say, you know, if you're going vegetarian or want to go in that direction, go to ethnic restaurants, because you can always find a lot.
And that's why when you go vegetarian or vegan, suddenly it's like, wow, there's all this new food to try.
Exactly. There's no shortage of food out there.
Your choices just become, like, way more than there was before. Mm-hmm. So I think we have our we might have our first guest on the line. The first guest on our show today is Dr. Hope Ferdosian from PCRM, the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Dr. Ferdosian is PCRM's Director of Research Policy. She has studied the psychological trauma suffered by chimpanzees used in invasive experiments. Today, she will be talking to us about the Great Ape Protection Act and why it is important to halt experiments with chimpanzees and other great apes. Welcome to Animal Voices, Dr. Ferdosian.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Mm-hmm. Now, to start off the conversation, I think it's important to ask, what is the Great Ape Protection Act?
Well, that's a great question. The Great Ape Protection Act is a bipartisan bill that's been introduced in the U.S. Congress by Representatives Towns, Reichert, Langevin, and Bartlett. And the bill would phase out invasive experiments on chimpanzees. It would also release federally owned chimpanzees to sanctuaries. And if the bill passes, hundreds of chimpanzees would go from laboratory cages to sanctuaries where they would be protected and taken care of for the rest of their lives.
Oh, that would be so wonderful. Dr. Ferdosian, why is the passage of the Great Ape Protection Act important?
Well, Congress really needs to pass the Great Ape Protection Act for numerous reasons, primarily because chimpanzees deserve protection. They're incredibly intelligent beings, and as a physician, I can tell you that there are many better ways to do this research that would benefit not only the chimpanzees, but also humans. Experimenting on chimpanzees is not the best way to protect human health.
Hmm. Now, what would the Great Ape Protection Act do?
Well, it would do three main things. One, it would completely ban invasive experiments on chimpanzees and other great apes, but chimpanzees are the great apes that are used in research in the U.S. And it would also release all the chimpanzees who are federally owned to sanctuaries. About half of the chimpanzee population in laboratories in the U.S. Are federally owned. About half of them are privately owned. And then finally, it would make permanent a moratorium on breeding chimpanzees for research.
Mm-hmm. So we're breeding them. We're not. Are we capturing them from the wild as well?
Well, chimpanzees have been captured from the wild and traded. That's no longer legal.
Mm.
We have been breeding them until recently, when the National Institutes of Health actually introduced a moratorium that has been renewed that prohibits the breeding of chimpanzees for research.
Dr. Ferdosian, I'm wondering, is it known how many chimpanzees are being kept in labs in the U.S.?
There are about 1,000 chimpanzees who are kept in labs in the U.S. About half of them are owned by the federal government, and half of them are privately owned, say, by pharmaceutical companies.
Okay.
So are you going to succeed here? Why do you think the Great Ape Protection Act will pass?
Well, I think we will succeed. It's just a matter of time. This bill has tremendous momentum and getting more and more momentum as days go by.
Mm-hmm.
We have more than 140 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives, and people just seem to realize that it's time to stop experimenting on chimpanzees.
Mm-hmm. I don't think people know about what we do to chimpanzees. What is so disturbing about chimpanzee research?
Well, you might be surprised to learn that laboratories in the United States are actually allowed to keep chimpanzees in cages about the size of an elevator or a kitchen table, sometimes for decades. Many of these chimpanzees have actually spent their entire lives in laboratories. And that's really akin to torture for these highly social, highly intelligent animals. They are locked up. They don't get the social contact they need. Like us, they're incredibly social animals. And then, of course, there are the experiments themselves. Chimpanzees are exposed to repeated darting with anesthetic guns, biopsies, surgical procedures. And, again, these experiments really haven't helped humans, but they've inflicted incredible suffering on chimpanzees.
Yeah, I'd like to touch on that a little bit. Why is it not beneficial for humans? Can you give us some examples?
Absolutely. For the past several decades, chimpanzees have been used in multiple forms of research, from testing certain chemicals to hepatitis or HIV research. As just taking hepatitis as an example, for 40 years, researchers have tried to develop a hepatitis C vaccine using chimpanzees as models. But chimpanzees just do not develop hepatitis C in the same way that humans do. They're rarely chronically infected with hepatitis C, whereas humans are much more likely to be affected by chronic hepatitis C. Chimpanzees are much less likely to experience liver fibrosis or cirrhosis or the form of cancer that we worry about with hepatitis C infection in humans. And there are also some real differences in terms of maternal-fetal transmission for both hepatitis B and C. In humans, we see a lot of maternal-fetal transmission of hepatitis B in particular. This just doesn't happen in the same way in chimpanzees. And we've seen similar failures in other areas. After decades of experiments on chimpanzees, more than 85 HIV/AIDS vaccines have demonstrated positive outcomes in chimpanzees, but none have been effective in human trials. And in fact, chimpanzees just don't develop AIDS the way that humans do.
Yeah, I've heard that before. They you can infect them with HIV, but they'll never get AIDS. So why is it that we keep experimenting on them, knowing that they don't develop these diseases?
Well, I think that that's a great question, and the United States is actually the only country in the world that is still making large-scale use of chimpanzees in invasive experiments. Most other countries have actually stopped experimenting on chimpanzees. One, because obviously they realize that these are intelligent animals that deserve something better, but also because scientists are acknowledging that experiments on chimpanzees have failed. In fact, even in the U.S., the majority of chimpanzees are actually not on active protocols. They're just languishing in the laboratories and costing taxpayers money.
Now, just a little bit about the chimpanzees. You talk about how they live in these tiny cages for their entire lives. Can you tell us a little bit about how intelligent chimpanzees are?
Sure. Chimpanzees are just amazing, amazing individuals, amazing animals. They use tools. They can solve complex problems. You've probably heard that chimpanzees can be taught and learn American Sign Language. They're, as I mentioned earlier, incredibly social animals. They love being around others. It's actually quite tragic that many of these amazing animals are locked up sometimes in solitary confinement as a result of the research protocols that they're on.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say they're locked up in little cages. Do they get to have, you know, exercise time like prisoners do?
Good question.
Well, that's a great question.
They are essentially prisoners.
Yeah.
That's a great question. Typically, there are certain standards under the Animal Welfare Act in the United States that require certain types of behavioral enrichment, but it certainly isn't what is needed for, you know, a chimpanzee to live a normal, healthy life. And I just returned from East Africa as part of a study that some colleagues and I are doing, and chimpanzees live free in the wild, and the difference between those chimpanzees and the chimpanzees living in laboratories, you know, here in the U.S. is just incredibly, incredibly telling.
Mm. And I guess, you know, in these labs, they can't really let them go out to get some fresh air, because what they're doing is they're brutalizing them all the time. And if they decide to take them out for a walk, that's not going to happen, because these animals are huge.
They're going to want to escape.
Yeah.
I think what they would want to do.
And they'll probably want to beat you up or something, because they're kind of big, aren't they?
Chimpanzees are incredibly powerful. They really put us to shame, actually.
Yeah, yes. So you say that Congress will actually save taxpayers quite a bit of money by passing the Great Ape Protection Act. Can you explain that?
Sure. The Great Ape Protection Act would save taxpayers in the U.S. an incredible amount of money, retiring the approximately 500 federally owned chimpanzees to sanctuary could save about $200 million dollars, and we'd save even more through the prohibition on breeding and invasive research. Right now, there are quite a bit of money going toward research protocols, even if the federal government doesn't own those chimpanzees.
Mm-hmm. Now, could you tell me a little bit about your research focusing on chimpanzees living in sanctuaries?
Sure. Well, in particular, my colleague, Dr. Deborah Durham, who's a primatologist, and several of our study partners and I have been conducting a purely observational study of chimpanzees who had been in laboratories but now are lucky enough to live in sanctuaries. And we found in our pilot study, and our work is ongoing, that the chimpanzees that have lived in laboratories display signs of depression and even mm-hmm. post-traumatic stress disorder, and some chimpanzees may even severely self-mutilate themselves.
Mm. Just like humans do if they're depressed or psychological trauma.
How long can they be kept in these cages and labs and experimented on?
Well, some of these chimpanzees are actually quite elderly by now. I'm 40, 50 years old even.
What's the lifespan of a chimpanzee?
It can be up to 40 or 50 years of age.
Entire lives they've been in labs.
Yes, yes. Many of them, you know, those that weren't bred were, when it was legal, taken from the wild and put into labs.
Wow. So do you see big changes in particular chimpanzees after relocating them from laboratory cages to a sanctuary?
Absolutely. Getting out of laboratory cages has huge benefits for chimpanzees that have been forced to live in labs all of their lives. I can give you several examples, but one in particular. I met a chimpanzee named Negra at Chimpanzee Sanctuary Northwest, which is a sanctuary based just outside of Seattle. Phenomenal sanctuary and phenomenal group of people dedicated to making the lives of chimpanzees better. And Negra came from a laboratory where she had been used in invasive vaccine experiments, and she'd also been used for breeding, and her babies had been taken away from her, not unlike many other chimpanzees. And when she arrived at the sanctuary, she showed signs of depression. She was socially withdrawn. Her sleep patterns were abnormal. But she's improved dramatically from what I understand. The sanctuary really, really is important to the long-term care of these individual chimpanzees.
Mm-hmm. Could you describe for our listeners, I know, surprisingly perhaps, quite a few people that I've spoken to don't even know what an animal sanctuary is, because it's not something that I guess is very mainstream mm-hmm. out there, unless you're living in it like Joanne and I, and I'm sure you are. You know, what are the living conditions like at these sanctuaries, if you can describe for us, for the chimpanzees?
Sure. Well, there are, of course, good sanctuaries and sanctuaries that aren't quite up to standard.
Right.
But the sanctuaries that we're working with, especially as part of our study, are just phenomenal. First of all, you know, you have caregivers that are there for the chimpanzees in this case, or for the animals in this case. And generally, the chimpanzees can go outside, you know, if weather doesn't prohibit it.
Mm-hmm.
And then come inside, and they're free to either socialize with other chimpanzees or to be on their own. So they're actually given quite a bit more autonomy than they had while they were living in laboratories.
They're allowed to live out their lives as individuals, is basically when it comes down to, which they're not when they're locked up in cages in the labs, of course. And I think, you know, every living creature has the right to do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you convince these labs to give up the apes or the chimpanzees?
Well, I'm not doing that work, and I applaud the people who are.
Okay.
And many of the sanctuaries actually, you know, walk a delicate balance of working with the laboratories to try and secure long-term care in the sanctuary for chimpanzees that are ready to be released according to the lab.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason I asked that question is, you know, with factory farms, people actually have to go and dig out the trash for live ones in order to get them. And it's like...
You're saying that a lot of these chimpanzees are just sort of laying dormant in these labs because there's not use for them at this time. So I would think that the people running these labs would be willing to give them up, you know, willingly, but I'm curious as to what keeps them in these labs without having a use for them. Are they just keeping them to wait for perhaps some time where they might find a need for them, or like what's behind that in these labs there in the U.S.?
Yeah, I'm not sure the answer to that, because I think it's one of the best questions, you know, and the laboratories and the federal government could probably answer that better than I can. But there's no doubt that keeping these chimpanzees in laboratories is inflicting incredible suffering on them, and then also not producing the what was promised in terms of human health benefits, and then, of course, costing taxpayers a lot of money.
Right. Now, what can concerned listeners do to get involved in this issue?
Well, you can spread the word. Mm-hmm. Let as many people as you know, especially people who are constituents of U.S. senators and representatives who have not yet signed on to the bill as co-sponsors, mm-hmm. let them know about the bill and what it would do and how important it is. And you can get more contact information and just more general information on our website, pcrm.org.
Great. Our technician, John, has a question for you.
Hello, Dr. Rivers-Sogan. Is it true that the great apes, there's no experimentation, or there's a ban, rather, on experimentation on great apes in Britain?
There is, actually. The UK stopped issuing licenses for chimpanzee experiments back in 1997. And many other countries have either banned or severely limited the practice.
Do you recall that Peter Singer was actually in favor of lifting that ban if the need should arise, as though he actually believed in animal experimentation, and he's actually promoting it? And he's supposed to be the guru of animal rights.
I didn't know that.
What do you have any comment about that?
I actually have tremendous respect for Dr. Singer, and I think that what's important to realize is that, you know, again, chimpanzees are incredibly social, incredibly intelligent animals that need social contact and freedom where possible, and respect.
But Dr. Singer doesn't. He thinks, you know, if need arises, we should lift the ban, and that seems a clear indication to me that he doesn't understand the issue. But that's just me.
I don't see how the need could arise from what the Dr. Fedosian is telling us here. That just seems quite backward.
And another thing, the reason to have these animals still locked up is the excuse that they're infectious. Isn't that right? And is that really true?
Well, although chimpanzees are infected with various diseases, some of them are on infectious diseases protocols like hepatitis and HIV protocols, and that results in certain laboratory practices and isolating certain chimpanzees from other chimpanzees who aren't infected. You know, they really don't acquire the diseases in the same way that humans do.
Right. And they don't display them the same way, and they're not really infectious to anyone. But this pretext has to be kept up in order to legitimize and, you know, just sort of make it just to legitimize animal experimentation.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much, John, for your questions. And thank you so much, Dr. Fedosian, for joining us. We're all out of time now.
Thank you. I learned a lot.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. I think right now we have a draw.
Okay. We're going to do our giveaway. Wasn't sure, but
Allison's been waiting all day for this.
Yeah, all day, all week, actually. So if you remember from last week, we were going to be giving away a copy of the book, Building an Ark, 101 Solutions to Animal Suffering. And we actually had the author of this book, Ethan Smith, on our show last week, which was an excellent interview.
It was.
And you can find that on our website at animalvoices.org if you want to listen to it. Also on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. So we did have some people enter the draw for this book, and we are going to do the draw right now. And I just want to mention that I noticed today that all the entrants, their names all begin with A.
So really? Wow, interesting. You didn't enter, did you?
No.
You told me I couldn't enter.
No, we're not allowed to enter. So I guess,
she's got her little cup there, and she's mixing up the names.
We can see who the winner is. So the lucky winner is Amanda Leach. Congratulations, Amanda.
Yay.
We will be shooting you an email on how you can pick up your book. And once again, you can listen to our that show on our website, animalvoices.org, or our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. And
great.
We have the news now.
The news. Julio Aparicio, one of Spain's most famous matadors, was gored in the throat this week during a bullfight. The injury has left him in critical condition. The horn of the bull went through the tongue and penetrated the roof of the mouth, fracturing the jawbone, one of the medics who worked on Aparicio told AFP News in Madrid. Unfortunately, after two operations, it appears the matador's life was saved.
Was that an editorial on your part?
Yes.
Unfortunately?
The bull, however, was immediately surrounded by other matador thugs and killed. Yeah, that was editorial too. The incident took place during the Festival of Saint Isidro, considered to be the most important event in the bullfighting calendar.
From what I've heard, the bullfights are really just there for tourist attractions.
Really?
Yes. I don't know too much about it, but from the little I've read,
it's so sad.
It's a big tourist attraction.
Have you seen the picture with the horn going through the guy's mouth?
No, I didn't know about the story, actually. I don't think I had heard about this one.
Okay, the next one. This story has been consuming me all week. I'm sure you've heard about it. Everybody has heard about it. Mercy for Animals released an undercover footage Tuesday that showed workers at an Ohio dairy farm beating cows with crowbars, stabbing their inflamed udders with pitchforks, and punching baby calves in the heads. The video shows workers at Conklin Dairy Farm holding down newborn baby calves and stomping on their heads. It shows one worker wiring a cow's nose to a metal bar near the ground and repeatedly beating it with a crowbar until she's bleeding. Gary Conklin, the owner of the fourth generation family-operated farm, issued a statement yesterday after the video came out to light. He said, "The video shows animal care that is clearly inconsistent with the high standards we set for our farm and its workers, and we find the specific mistreatment shown on the video to be reprehensible and unacceptable." Ironically, Gary Conklin himself appeared in the video kicking a downed cow.
Wow, inconsistent with his own standards, I see.
The video can be viewed at mercyforanimals.org/ohdairy. Activists on Facebook are encouraging people to call the city prosecutor's office at 937-644-8151 to politely encourage the prosecutors to arrest not just the workers, but the owner and shut down the abusive farm. And that number again is 937-644-8151.
I have to say that my Facebook has been flooded with articles about this story this week, and it's really, hopefully it's not just my Facebook and yours, but I think it really is getting out there in the mainstream news this week.
It
was on CNN this week, and ABC covered it, Fox News covered it. It's really getting out there, and we'll be covering it next week.
That's right. Yeah, Nathan Runkle will be here.
Nathan Runkle, the executive director of Mercy for Animals, which is the group that conducts these undercover investigations. And they've done a couple other ones in the past year. He'll be coming on our show next week.
Yeah, so I've heard some interviews with him, and he's saying that this is, in his 10 years of doing investigative work, this is the most disturbing investigation that he's ever done. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, just the maliciousness of how they beat up those animals. And we talk a lot on the show about just the systematic abuse in a dairy farm. And, you know, that's not even including all this crazy abuse that is imposed on these animals. So I'm very excited to have
I'm looking forward to talking about that more next week. You're listening to 102.7 FM CFRO, Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And now we have our upcoming events. Ongoing until Sunday, June the 13th, there is an art display happening at the Gallery Gachet, which is called Animals as Subject, Exploring the Complex Relationship Between Humans and Animals. Man and Beast Have a Long History. A.J. Brown, Rob McGinnis, Karen Moe, Venus Sobrains, and Dylan Woolney examine the friendly and not-so-friendly sides of this bond in Animals as Subject. McGinnis channels Annie Leibovitz and links the fashion world to the barnyard in the Farm Family Project. Moe's Wilderness Collage Series celebrates animals as subjects, not objects to eat. If you're closing in on cat lady territory, Brown's I didn't write that. Brown's paintings of furry friends are sure to please. The exhibit is on display at Gallery Gachet, and you can find out more by visiting their website, www.gallerygachet.org. That's spelled G-A-C-H-E-T, and it's located at 88 East Cordova Street in Vancouver. On Saturday, May the 29th, that's tomorrow at 2:45 p.m., there will be a lecture called Animal Communication, How to Speak Dog at the University of British Columbia. This is part of the UBC Alumni Weekend. It's free of charge, but it is only for UBC alumni members and their guests. Since the time of Darwin, scientists have been trying to understand how animals communicate. Today, psychologists know enough about this process so that it can be applied to allow you to understand the language of your pet dog, or even your pet cat, who speaks a somewhat different dialect. This lecture is by Stanley Coren, who is best known to the public for his series of best-selling books on dogs, and is also a well-respected scientist and professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia. To register, go to www.alumni.ubc.ca and click on UBC Alumni Weekend. On Monday, May the 31st at 9:05 p.m., Part 3, the conclusion of this three-part series, will be playing on CBC 690 AM Radio in Canada. This is a radio documentary called Have Your Meat and Eat It Too. I started listening to Part 1 of this series this week online, and I'm finding it very interesting.
Really?
Yeah. Yep. So we North Americans love our meat. It's cheap, it's plentiful, and oh so satisfying. Who except vegetarians can resist the smell of steak, chicken, or ribs sizzling on the barbecue? What was once reserved for special occasions has become our everyday fare, sometimes for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Every year, the average North American chomps through 30 whole chickens, a third of a pig, and a tenth of a cow. That's about a half a pound of meat a day, and that's not just in North America. Worldwide, the per capita consumption of meat has doubled in the past half century. In this three-part series, Jill Eisenman asks the question, what do we really know about the meat we buy? And this is part of the promo that CBC has put on. Meat eating has gotten a bad rap in recent years. It's blamed for everything from animal cruelty to global warming to swine flu and cancer. But Jill Eisen argues it's not meat that's the problem, it's the way we raise it. Most of our meat comes from mega farms housing thousands of animals. It certainly does. Happily, there are alternatives that are humane, healthy, and kind to the environment. So if you want to find out more about what they mean about that, I do recommend you can check out parts 1 and 2 on cbc.ca. I'm going to continue listening to it, and I'd like to bring up this documentary for discussion, as I've been finding, even just in the first 10 minutes of listening to part 1, that, wow, there's so many things here that I want to bring up and talk about and have opinions on. So we'll probably be having an editorial on my part about that soon.
Right. And you know, like when they say humane meat and family farm operations, we just saw in that Conklin Dairy Farm investigation.
That is a family farm
That's
operation.
That's a family farm.
There you go. From June 2nd to June 9th, Brandon Brazier's Thrive Speaking Tour will be happening in British Columbia. Professional triathlete, plant-based nutrition expert, and best-selling author Brandon Brazier will be sharing how to thrive on a whole foods plant-based diet. Based on his best-selling books, The Thrive Diet and Thrive Fitness, Brandon shares tips for reducing stress, losing weight, and staying healthy. Seminars will be hosted in Vancouver, Burnaby, Richmond, Langley, Surrey, and Squamish. For details, visit the website www.vegacommunity.com/events. If you have an animal or vegetarian-related event coming up that you would like to have announced on the show, please email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, which is called Animal Voices Vancouver.
You're listening to Animal Voices on 102.7 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio. Chef Tal Ronan is currently one of, if not the most well-known vegan chef in North America. His cookbook, The Conscious Cook, was number 3 in the New York Times bestseller, and we have a copy right here in the studio. In 2008, Tal Ronan became Oprah's personal chef when she went on a 21-day vegan cleanse. He catered Ellen DeGeneres' wedding as well as the first vegan dinner at the U.S. Senate. We're so thrilled to have caught up with him earlier this week via Skype, and here's a recording of our conversation. Now listen carefully, because I will tell you how you can win a copy of his book, The Conscious Cook, at the end of the interview. John, hit it. Welcome to Animal Voices, Tal.
Thanks for having me.
I just wanted to say that it's both a pleasure and an honor to be able to speak to you today.
Likewise.
Now, the vegan movement has produced a lot of cooks and chefs, probably because until recently, the majority of us have to do a lot of home cooking just to eat. However, you've gone a step above most vegans and became not just an ordinary chef, but a gourmet chef. What inspired you to become a vegan gourmet chef?
You know, it was really out of frustration of not being able to eat the foods that I remembered growing up as living in a family that were foodies. Both my parents loved great food, and in New York we were exposed to every kind of food. And, you know, I think I had, you know, chopsticks in my hands by the time I was 3, and we were just always around great, great food. And when I became a vegetarian, I was definitely frustrated with what was available both at restaurants and at home, and that was definitely the inspiration to go to culinary school and learn how to cook professionally.
Out of all the vegan chefs, no one has managed to get the attention and the acceptance from the mainstream public like you have. What do you think sets your style of vegan cooking apart from all the others?
I think it's a combination of things. I think as a society, people are much more receptive to eating vegetarian and vegan, whether it's for health reasons or environmental reasons. But definitely my style of cooking is more focused on traditional French culinary techniques, where a lot of cookbooks that were vegetarian in the past are written by home cooks. And I've definitely found that applying French culinary techniques to vegetarian food, you can create food that's a lot more satisfying for someone who's used to the taste of meat. So, you know, I'm not afraid to use really good fats, and if you like meaty textures and hearty sauces and things like that, you'll definitely like my style of cooking. I think in the past, people have focused on vegetarian cooking as being low fat or no fat. And I think that's definitely why someone who's used to eating, you know, animal-based protein 3 times a day hasn't found that style of cooking very appealing, or hasn't really found it satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Last year, Oprah went on a 21-day vegan cleanse, and you were chosen to be her chef during that time. Now, Oprah is a full-on meat eater, but she raved about your cooking and the blog.
Yeah, it was actually 2 years ago. I wouldn't say she's a full-on meat eater, but she definitely, you know, she's not a vegetarian or a vegan, but she's definitely conscious of the food choices she makes.
Interesting. I know she blogged about your cooking, and she just raved about it. I'm just wondering what that experience was like for you.
It was a bit scary. I was working with my friend Chad Sarno in London, opening up his restaurant called Sass, when I got the call. At first, I didn't want to leave because we were 2 days away from opening the first gourmet vegan restaurant in London. You know, everyone said, you're crazy, you got to go. So I did, and, you know, after meeting her and seeing how down to earth she was and how really sweet she was to be around, it was pretty easy as far as that goes. The challenging part was the cleanse was more than just a vegan diet. It was also alcohol-free,
right,
gluten-free, sugar-free. So, you know, I'm used to cooking without those restrictions. So that was a bit tough, and obviously having her blog about what you're serving her breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day for 3 weeks can be a little nerve-wracking,
yeah.
But it was a great experience and something I'll definitely never forget.
You think she'll ever go veg?
You know, I think she eats a lot of vegetarian food, and I can't speak for her, but she's, you know, definitely incorporated more vegetarian food into her diet.
That's really wonderful to hear because she has such great influence on people.
She does, definitely.
You recently published a cookbook called The Conscious Cook, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners own the book as it was in the New York Times bestseller list. What are some of the dishes that we can find in the cookbook?
The recipes in the book are really based on things that I missed eating, things, familiar foods that I grew up eating as a kid. So, you know, everything from a take on oysters Rockefeller to really creamy soups, entrees that have a center of the plate protein. I think another huge reason that vegetarian food has not been appealing is when you go out to a restaurant or a hotel and you ask for the vegetarian option, even if it's a really good chef, it's usually an afterthought, and it's usually side dishes of vegetables that are put
right
together as an entree, and they don't have a protein component. And although, you know, I think we get more protein than we need in North America, lacking that protein component in that plate definitely makes vegetarian meals not as satisfying. So in the book, there's a whole chapter on plant-based proteins. And people are surprised to find out that, you know, the rest of the world really does get the bulk of their protein from plant-based sources, whether it's, you know, black beans in Mexico or whole grains in South America, soy in Asia, lentils in India. Not that all those cultures are necessarily vegetarian, but the bulk of their protein intake is plant-based, where meat is often just an accent on the plate. It's never really at the center of the plate like it is in North America. You know, we're eating animal-based protein 3 times a day, 7 days a week, you know, turkey for lunch, sausage, bacon for breakfast, salmon, steak for dinner, 3 times a day, 7 days a week. This is certainly why I think we lead the world in heart disease, cancer, stroke, obesity. So, you know, even by eating a couple vegetarian meals a week, you can have a tremendous impact on your own health and on the environment.
Definitely.
So it's not all or nothing, that's for sure.
Right. And I definitely can relate to what you're saying, going to fancy restaurants. I won't name any names, but ordering a vegan dish and just getting, like, side dishes and veggie scraps.
Yeah, you know, even some of my favorite chefs, my heroes really and biggest influences now are doing vegetarian tasting menus in big cities, and there's still that lack of having a protein component. That's why I really focused on that in the book. Every entree in the entree section has a center of the plate protein, and there's a chapter describing, you know, how other cultures get their protein. We have an interview with the guy who first brought quinoa to North America, which is a great source of protein, and the person who first started incubating tempeh in North America, another great source of protein. An interview with Eve Putfan, who started Eve's Veggie Cuisine and now Garden Protein, which is just really an amazingly convincing plant-based protein that's being used by chefs all over the U.S. Even Gordon Ramsay used it in another
Philadelphia
kitchen. Yeah.
I'm surprised.
And fooled his contestants with it, which was really cool.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, Gardein is definitely something to look out for because unlike most vegetarian meat substitutes, you can cook with it. You know, it's not a veggie dog or a burger that goes in between the bun. You can actually cook with it. It comes in a format that lets you cook with it. So really great product to look out for.
And definitely I can attest to that. I have fooled meat eaters with the Gardein protein. They think it's chicken. So.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's a great diverse protein, whereas a lot of the other products are just, you know, highly processed soy.
Mm-hmm.
Gardein is a blend of, there is soy in it, but it's got pea protein, it's got ancient grains like quinoa and amaranth. Really great, healthy product.
And you helped develop that, didn't you?
I work with a company on developing new flavors and formats. The person who was really behind developing it was Yves Putfan, and I was so impressed with what he showed me even 4 years ago that I really thought that this was key to getting people to eat more vegetarian food, and that's why I work with him now.
That's great, and that's made locally right here in Vancouver, so it's something we can be very proud of.
Definitely, and it's now in, you know, I think close to 7,000 supermarkets in North America. It's all over the place. It's great.
That's wonderful. You cooked the first vegan dinner at the U.S. Senate. What was the occasion?
I developed the menu for the event. It was an event that the Humane Society of the United States had at the Senate, and we used Gardein as the center of the plate, did a recipe that's featured in my book called the Peanut and Basil Seared Gardein with a lobster mushroom bouillon, and it went over really well. There was a Senate historian there that said that it was the first all-vegan meal served at the Senate. People really enjoyed it.
When you were learning to be a chef, did you ever think you'd become a celebrity chef cooking the first meal for the U.S. Senate and for Oprah and Ellen?
No, that's certainly not my goal. My goal was to, you know, make, you know, better vegetarian food more accessible. You know, the spotlight and everything that's come with it is not something that comes easy for me, but, you know, it's been a process.
You recently did a cooking demo at the Le Cordon Bleu in St. Louis, Missouri. Now, I can't imagine that Le Cordon Bleu is a place where they care much for vegan food. What was the reaction like from the students and the instructors there?
It's been tremendous. It's been with all the Cordon Bleu campuses in North America. I've been touring the country now since January, hitting all 14 campuses. And this is something that we did in conjunction with Le Cordon Bleu. And they're not only supportive of it, but have just gotten really tremendous feedback. They've said that both the students and staff have enjoyed these workshops more than any other workshops that they've had recently. And I think that's because they realize that, you know, vegetarian requests are becoming very popular and giving the students and the staff there some good ammunition to create good vegetarian meals when they go out in the workforce, when they graduate, when they work in hotels and restaurants. Is very much appreciated, and they like my respect for traditional French culinary techniques, and it's very easy for them and for me to have a conversation about this because we both come from the same place, and by doing what they're already doing, learning these techniques and subbing a few ingredients and still really concentrating on the techniques that they learn at the school, they can create vegetarian dishes that have never been done before.
That's pretty amazing. You're opening doors everywhere. Earlier this year, a Canadian chef survey listed vegan entrees as number 3 in the top 10 up-and-coming Canadian menu trends. Are you surprised?
I don't know if I'm surprised. I always am a bit surprised at the lack of good vegetarian options in Canada. I think in the U.S. and the U.K. and in other parts of the world have a little bit of a step up. But it's not surprising. Again, I think, you know, things are really coming to a head with the environment and healthcare costs because of food-related illnesses like, you know, heart disease. And, you know, we're treating people's cholesterol problems with pills instead of diet. So I think more and more people are becoming conscious of that. And the environment is just a huge part of it. You know, the UN Secretary General said that, and the UN is a very conservative organization, said that one of the best things you can do to combat global warming is to eat vegetarian. So. I'm not surprised. I think Canadians are very forward-thinking people and very conscious of the environment and how they eat. So I think it's just going to keep growing.
Wow. That's definitely a positive outlook. So you've been traveling all over doing demos and signing books. You obviously meet a lot of people who are already vegan or vegetarian, but I'm more interested in hearing about the people you meet who are not vegetarian or vegan, but are interested in learning more about eating plant-based foods. Who are these people and why are they interested in your food?
You know, they range from foodies who have seen some of the techniques in the book that, vegan cuisine can be the great next frontier in cooking because you're really having to innovate when creating dishes. And so a lot of chefs are very interested in that for that reason because it's innovative and it's cutting edge. So I meet a lot of people who are foodies and come to me at the book signings to talk to me about that. And then I meet a lot of people who, like you said, are vegetarian. And then there's the people who are really concerned about their health and their weight. And so it's just been really a positive experience meeting people all over the country who are interested in changing their diet, and that's really going to have such an impact on everything in society, from, you know, our healthcare costs to environmental impacts and the way animals are raised for food in North America. It's all tied together.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes left, but since I have you on the line, I can't resist asking some practical cooking questions.
Sure.
What are some of the basic tools that every good vegan cook must have in their kitchen?
You know, I wouldn't say necessarily vegan cook, but basic tools for cooking, you know, really good pans, stainless steel or copper pans. I don't like to use nonstick pans. You'll always find a pair of tongs and a side towel in my hand, and that's for two reasons. You know, one, because I always make a mess, so I like to have plenty of side towels to clean up, but also that's to pick up hot things. And when you work in restaurants, you know, you're used to picking up hot pans, and so tongs are great, and your hands too are great tools. You know, there's nothing like dressing a salad with your hands instead of, you know, a pair of tongs or wooden spoons, which could really break delicate leafy vegetables. Yeah, as far as ingredients go, I love, you know, to stick to a really whole foods diet at home, so lots of whole grains. You know, in the pantry I always have different sorts of dried beans and grains and different sweeteners, you know, from maple syrup to agave syrup, or agave nectar rather, which is a great sweetener that I've been using a lot and is used in a lot of the dressings and desserts in the book. And, you know, always having fresh seasonal vegetables is great to have on hand. And substitutes for dairy, like almond milk is great. I have, you know, often I'll have cereal with almond milk in the morning, and butter substitutes like Earth Balance, you know, meat substitutes like Gardein. These are the types of things that you see more in someone who's transitioning to a whole foods diet.
Right.
But they're definitely fun to have around.
Do you have any plans for opening up a vegan cooking school so aspiring vegan chefs can learn to cook like you?
You know, I really, I love the work I'm doing with Le Cordon Bleu. I think it's absolutely a necessity to learn traditional cooking techniques.
Okay.
You know, I always run into vegetarian students at Le Cordon Bleu campuses, and I tell them that I'm so proud of them for being there and learning how to cook traditionally and learning how to cook with meat and how to make stocks and sauces that are traditional, because if they don't know how to do that, they're never going to be able to make a good vegetarian version of that.
Wow.
And I feel that's really important for someone to be a good chef or a good cook, is to have those fundamentals.
And that's a really important tip, because I don't think most people who are vegetarian would even consider wanting to cook meat and that sort of thing. So that's
It depends what your goal is in life. I can see that might be off-putting to some people, but if your goal is to become a great chef and to bring more people on board with that style of eating, it might be the best way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been so great talking to you.
No, it's great to be here, and I appreciate you guys having me on.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was Tal Ronan, gourmet vegan chef and author of The Conscious Cook.
Thanks.
Just need to turn that off. And you have a chance to win a copy of this book if you answer this question correctly. Name one kitchen tool Chef Ronan says is a must in every kitchen. To answer this question, of course, you have to have listened to the interview with Tal that we just played. If you've missed the interview or if you need to listen to the show again, please visit our website at www.animalvoices.org. We should have the show posted for you over the weekend. The question again is, name one kitchen tool Chef Ronan says is a must-have in every kitchen. You can submit the answer by emailing us at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or respond on Facebook at Animal Voices Vancouver or on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. All answers should be submitted to us before our next show on June the 4th. You've been listening to the Animal Voices Radio Show on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Remember to sign up on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. You can also join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR, and please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Remember, we are looking for guest co-hosts to come on the show every now and then. If this interests you and you can make it to our studio in Vancouver on a Friday, please email us to discuss at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We're also looking for people who are interested in working in the control room during the show, so please shoot us an email if that interests you as well. Next week on the show, please join us again as we'll be interviewing Nathan Runkel, Executive Director of Mercy for Animals, which is the organization that broke their undercover cruelty investigation of workers at an Ohio dairy farm to the media this week. And it's really been getting into the mainstream media during this whole week. Nathan will be elaborating with us on the investigation's findings and the whole dairy issue. Thanks for listening.